yourself as comfortable as possible and adjust your posture to minimize discomfort. When unpleasant sensations arise, ignore them as long as you can. Resist the urge to move for relief. When the discomfort becomes too much to ignore, turn your attention toward the pain and make it the focus of your attention. Remember, when training the mind, you always want to intentionally choose the focus of your intention. So, whenever a distraction grows too strong to ignore, whether it's pain in the body or the sound of a jackhammer outside the window, you purposely make it into your meditation object. Observe the unpleasant sensation without moving for as long as you can. If it disappears or decreases enough to be ignored, return to the sensations of the breath. If, instead, the urge to move becomes irresistible, decide in advance when you'll move, for example, at the end of the next out-breath, exactly what movement you'll make, for example, move your leg or raise your hand to scratch the itch, and then be very observant as you perform that movement. After you move, the discomfort often returns quickly or reappears elsewhere. When you see this keeps happening, you'll become less concerned with moving because you realize there's no point. It becomes easier to stay with the pain and investigate it longer. We'll discuss meditating with pain and discomfort more in Stage 4 when they're even more distracting. For now, just remember that by meditating on these harmless sources of pain, we gain insight into the nature of desire and aversion by watching how resistance and impatience create suffering. As you progress, you will discover a profound truth. In life, as in meditation, physical pain is unavoidable, but suffering of every kind is entirely optional. Dullness and drowsiness. Once you start to have longer periods of stable attention, you will face the problem of drowsiness and falling asleep. Why does dullness arise right when our concentration starts to improve? The first reason is that when we meditate, we intentionally turn the mind inward. But we've been conditioned our entire life to associate turning inward with going to sleep. The second is that as we succeed in taming the mind and calming its normal state of relative agitation, the overall energy level drops. There is a famous Buddhist simile of training a young elephant by tethering it to a stake. At first, the elephant lunges in every direction, trying to escape. When it realizes it can't, it lies down and goes to sleep. In the same way, as we tether the mind to the meditation object, we restrain its natural tendency to seek stimulation, and it falls asleep. As with the elephant, the untrained mind needs stimulation to stay awake. Dullness in meditation comes in many different degrees, ranging from strong dullness, such as drowsiness, to subtler forms, like feeling a bit spaced out. Drowsiness often makes an appearance at this stage. As with distraction, dullness is another form of scattered attention. But while distraction scatters attention to other objects of awareness, dullness scatters attention to a void in which nothing is perceived at all. The dullness and drowsiness we're concerned with here are due specifically to meditation practice and need to be clearly distinguished from dullness due to other causes. Obviously, if you're fatigued by mental or physical stress, illness, or lack of sleep, you'll be sleepy during meditation. So regard a good night's rest as an important part of your practice. When you meditate also makes a difference. Most people get drowsy after eating or strenuous physical activity, and the early part of the afternoon or late evening can be sleepy times as well. If you're well rested and have taken all these other factors into account but still find yourself getting drowsy, you'll know it's dullness related to meditation. Working with drowsiness. In meditation, drowsiness usually leads to brief moments of sleep. Within a few seconds of falling asleep, postural muscles relax, and your head nods or your body starts to fall. Then you wake up with a sudden jerk as muscle reflexes pull you upright, the so-called Zen lurch. Of course, if you're lying down or sitting in a comfortable chair, you might sleep for a long time. This is why you shouldn't meditate in these positions, unless arthritis or some other health condition absolutely requires it. If you've just jerked awake, within a short time you'll probably feel dullness setting in again, like a heavy cloak. When this happens, you have a great opportunity to investigate how dullness develops and turns into drowsiness. If you closely observe what happens, you'll notice that coming out of drowsiness is distinctly unpleasant. You would probably prefer to stay there. However, by resisting the urge and returning to the practice, you'll usually experience a comfortable state where you can still follow the breath, though without the same intensity or vividness or clarity as before. This is called subtle dullness. It eventually leads to strong dullness, in which attention still clings to the breath, but the focus is weak and diffuse, and the sensations vaguely perceived. The drowsiness that precedes falling asleep feels like trying to see through dense fog. The breath often becomes distorted, transformed by dreamlike imagery, and nonsensical thoughts start drifting through the mind. Eventually, you do fall asleep. Working with subtle dullness as it arises can be quite productive, but struggling against strong dullness that's already present doesn't work well. So, if you're drowsy or have already dozed off during a session, you must first rouse the mind out of dullness. Then you can work with dullness as it starts to return. Here are a few antidotes, roughly in order of strength, from mild to strongest, for rousing the mind from dullness. Take 3 or 4 deep breaths, filling the lungs as much as possible, and hold for a moment. Then exhale as forcefully and completely as possible through tightly pursed lips. Tense all the muscles in your body until you begin to tremble slightly, then relax. Repeat several times. Meditate while standing up. Do walking meditation. Worst case scenario, get up, splash cold water on your face, then go back to practicing. These work because they stimulate you, not only physically, but mentally as well, by increasing the flow of external stimuli into your mind. In general, always do whatever is necessary to re-energize yourself back to a state of alert awareness. When drowsiness returns quite soon after you've roused yourself, it's called sinking, which feels like being caught in mental quicksand. Sinking is a sure sign that you didn't re-energize the mind enough. Keep using stronger antidotes until the drowsiness doesn't return for at least several minutes, but try not to do more than necessary, or you'll create a state of agitation. Now that you have roused your mind, keep it alert and energized by making sure your extrospective awareness doesn't collapse. Recall that dullness results from turning the mind too far inward and losing energy from lack of stimulation. If you find that focusing on the breath is causing extrospective awareness to fade, you can correct this by expanding awareness to include bodily sensations, sounds, and so forth, while not losing attention on the breath. However, you can also let the breath become secondary to a state of expanded, all-encompassing awareness for a little while. When you feel alert again, bring the focus of attention back to the sensations at the tip of the nose. You're looking for a balance between being too inward and too outward directed. Another way to keep the mind energized is through intention. Holding a strong, conscious intention to clearly perceive the breath sensations while also sustaining peripheral awareness will keep the mind energized. The intention should be set before the sensations actually appear. This keeps you attentive. But don't project too far ahead. For instance, set your intention at the pause before the out-breath to observe the very beginning of the out-breath. At the beginning of the out-breath, set the intention to observe sensations near the middle, and at the middle, set your intention to discern the end of the out-breath. Do the same for the in-breath. This close-up investigation takes practice. However, it energizes the mind and keeps you engaged enough so you don't as easily slip into drowsiness. Remember, it's always best to recognize and correct for dullness before it gets too strong. Introspective attention and eventually introspective awareness are what alert you to dullness before you get drowsy and fall asleep. So each time you check in for gross distractions, look for dullness as well. Also, keep in mind that your intention isn't just to get rid of sleepiness, but to learn about the nature of dullness. Therefore, follow the breath, and when dullness arises, consider it an opportunity to learn and practice. In time, through effort and training, dullness will naturally disappear. Conclusion. You have mastered stage 3 when forgetting and mind wandering no longer occur, and the breath stays continually in conscious awareness. This is a whole new pattern of behavior for your mind. The mind still roams, but it's tethered to the meditation object, never getting too far away. The unconscious mental processes that sustain attention never entirely let go of the meditation object. Because attention no longer shifts automatically to objects of desire and aversion, you can purposely hold your attention on an emotionally neutral object like the breath for extended periods of time. The ability to continuously sustain attention on the meditation object is remarkable, so take satisfaction in your accomplishment. You can now do something that most people can't, something you may not have thought you were even capable of. Congratulations. You have reached the first milestone achievement and the real beginning of skilled meditation. Third interlude. How mindfulness works. The practice of mindfulness leads to both psychological healing and profound spiritual insights. To understand how, we first need to look at the role of the mind in the formation of personality. Who we are today was shaped by our past. The imprints of past experiences exert a powerful influence on our emotional reactions and behavior in the present. Usually, we're not even aware of their effect. Think about how much of daily life actually consists of mindless, automatic behaviors driven by unconscious conditioning. Of course, these are intermingled with intentional actions. If an automatic response isn't immediately available, we have to consciously decide what to do or say. But even these conscious choices are strongly influenced by conditioned mental states, feelings, and what are sometimes called intuitions, deeply held views about people, ourselves, the world, moral values, and the very nature of reality. All this conditioning serves as a powerful but completely unconscious influence, guiding conscious decision-making processes in unseen ways. Unconscious conditioning is like a collection of invisible programs. These programs were set in motion, often long ago, by conscious experiences. Our reactions to those experiences, our thoughts, emotions, speech, and actions, may have been appropriate at the time. The problem is they've become programmed patterns, submerged in the unconscious, that don't change. They lie dormant until they're triggered by something in the present. When that happens, we often get so focused on the triggering event and our own emotions that these unconscious programs don't take in any new information about the current situation. That's why they don't change. The practice of mindfulness works because it provides new information to these programs. But how much reprogramming happens depends on our degree of mindfulness. In other words, mindfulness has different levels of application. At its most basic level, mindfulness is simply about moderating behavior. The magic of mindfulness, its power to transform you as a person, only starts working when we move beyond the first level. At the second level, by maintaining more powerful mindfulness for longer periods in daily life, we become less reactive and more intentionally present. The third level entails reprogramming the deep conditioning that has shaped our personality and only occurs in meditation. The fourth level is the radical reconditioning of the innate tendencies that create all our suffering and only occurs through insight experience. Level 1. Moderating behavior. Over and over, specific situations in daily life happen to trigger our programmed patterns of behavior. For example, if your partner, or even a stranger, says something that pushes one of your buttons, you may become angry or annoyed. Without mindfulness, we react emotionally instead of responding rationally and intentionally. Often, we just create more problems for ourselves. At the very least, we end up in a bad mood and become less effective at whatever we're doing. But if we can stay mindful, we'll also be calmer and not react as quickly or be so distracted by our own emotions. This allows us to be more attentive to our feelings and aware of the situation and the potential consequences of our actions, so we can regulate our behavior in positive ways. Just being aware that our suffering has more to do with our emotional reactions than with what triggered them can help us let go of those negative emotions more easily. Mindfully acknowledging our emotions and taking responsibility for our reactions lets us recognize more options, choose wiser responses, and take control of our behavior. Awareness in the present moment allows us to slow down and change our behavior, but it doesn't make any permanent changes. The next time we're in a similar situation, we'll behave in the same automatic, reactive way. Unless, of course, we're mindful once again. Level 2. Becoming less reactive and more responsive. Everyone would like to make smarter choices. However, healthier responses to life situations are only one of the benefits of attention and awareness working together. The true magic of mindfulness is something completely different, producing extraordinary spiritual and psychological transformations. That's why therapists now use mindfulness training to help treat all kinds of emotional and behavioral problems, such as stress, anger, phobias, compulsive behaviors, eating disorders, addiction, and depression. The magic of mindfulness allows these people to overcome the psychological root of their problems. Thus, people who have cultivated mindfulness are more attuned and less reactive. They have greater self-control and self-awareness, better communication skills and relationships, clearer thinking and intentions, and more resilience to change. How does this magic work? When attention isn't so totally captured by the intensity of the moment that awareness fades, we are able to observe ourselves more closely and consistently. Attention and awareness provide the unconscious mind with new, real-time information that is directly relevant to what's happening right now. Unconscious processes are informed that the reactions they're producing aren't appropriate in the current situation, harming more than helping. With this new information, reprogramming can happen at the deepest levels of the unconscious. And the longer we can be mindful in a particular situation, the more new information becomes available, and the more mindfulness can work its magic. However, the magic of mindfulness doesn't end with the event itself. Consciousness can continue to pick up on and communicate the consequences of the event and their effects on our mental state long afterward. So the duration of mindfulness is important, as is consistency. The more consistently we can apply mindfulness to similar situations in the future, the more its magic can change our conditioning. Whenever some event triggers one of our invisible programs, we have the chance to apply mindfulness to the situation so our unconscious conditioning can get reprogrammed. Anytime we're truly mindful of our reactions and their consequences, it can alter the way we will react in the future. Every time we experience a similar situation, our emotional reactions will get weaker and be easier to let go of. We can respond mindfully to the actual situation rather than reacting mindlessly. As we grow less reactive, we are empowered to respond more objectively and conscientiously. Eventually, those skillful qualities become our new conditioning. But what if our emotions and past conditioning are so powerful in the moment that we can't change how we feel and act? That's all right. As long as we stay mindful enough, we give our unconscious processes new information, and we will be more successful in the future. With repeated effort, we will become less reactive, maybe without even realizing it. Even if we lose mindfulness completely in the heat of the moment, we can still use it afterward to reflect on what happened, our reactions, and their impact on ourselves and others. By recalling the events vividly, examining them honestly and non-judgmentally, it will begin the process of reprogramming, which in turn makes it easier to stay mindful in the future. This is quite different from what usually happens. Because it's always painful to revisit a situation that made us uncomfortable, we typically like to put it out of our minds. Or, if we can't, we try to justify what we did and place the blame elsewhere. This keeps vital new information from reaching our unconscious mental processes. Mindfully examining our actions also means that we look objectively at our feelings about how we acted. We may see that we feel guilty, for example, and acknowledge that feeling guilty is an unpleasant consequence of our actions. But we shouldn't become submerged in that emotion. If you do find yourself getting caught up in self-reproach, you're just reacting from and reinforcing more unwholesome programming. Of course, it's much harder to stay mindful when it matters most, in difficult situations. That's why we need to intentionally practice mindfulness in everyday life, especially when it's easy, like when you're driving a car or eating a meal. Then you'll build up the skill and the mental muscle to stay mindful in the face of greater challenges. Level 3. Reprogramming Deep Conditioning. In daily life, even if we're mindful every moment, unskillful conditioning can only get reprogrammed when something triggers it. So, while it's essential to practice in daily life, mindfulness in formal meditation is even more effective because we don't have to wait for something to trigger an unconscious program to practice with. Instead, when our minds grow stable and quiet, all kinds of deep memories, thoughts, and emotions that drive our unconscious programs can come to the surface. Then they can be purified by the illuminating power of mindfulness. The reprogramming that occurs in meditation also transforms the way we think, feel, and act in more radical and broadly effective ways. That's because the unconscious conditioning that emerges is of a more fundamental nature, driving a wide range of reactive behaviors that would otherwise require many different triggering events. Conditioning of such a fundamental nature usually remains deeply hidden, but can surface in the stillness of meditation. Therefore, the application of mindfulness in meditation can rapidly accomplish much more than ever could be by the piecemeal process of confronting conditioning in daily life. To really understand and appreciate this deep purification of mind, it helps to consider how past experiences shape and condition our lives in the present. Recall that every experience leaves an imprint in our minds. The more emotionally powerful the experience, the stronger the imprint. Most of us have a large backlog of imprints from emotionally charged or traumatic events that don't fit in with the person we've become. These unresolved pieces of our personal history remain deeply buried in the psyche. Often they are too painful or involve too much internal conflict for us to confront and resolve head-on. The events themselves may have been forgotten, but the unconscious conditioning they left behind influences our behavior in ways we often don't recognize. Some of our conditioned reactions may help us, but many don't. And even helpful conditioning can appear at inappropriate times or in inappropriate ways. Consider, for example, the psychological challenges many war veterans face on return to civilian life, when previously useful combat training gets in the way of readjusting to the everyday world. This is because whenever our past conditioning is triggered, it creates strong emotions that drive us to behave in specific ways. Each person's conditioned behavior, the way he or she typically acts and reacts, is absolutely unique. In fact, what we call personality is precisely this set of behaviors. And while having personality is a wonderful thing, most people have personality traits that aren't particularly useful. Some traits are simply harmful, but with mindfulness, we can purify that deep conditioning and change our personality for the better. This purification occurs mainly in stage 4, but also at stage 7. Level 4. Mindfulness, Insight, and the End of Suffering. Unquestionably, the most valuable effect of mindfulness is its ability to radically reprogram our deepest misconceptions about the nature of reality and about who and what we are. Our gut intuition tells us we are separate selves in a world of other people and objects, and that our individual suffering and happiness depend on external circumstances. This may seem like common sense, but it's a misperception that comes from our innate programming and which is continually reinforced by cultural conditioning. As we practice mindfulness, however, we accumulate more and more evidence that things are very different from what we believed. In particular, the thoughts and feelings and memories we associate with a sense of self are seen more objectively, revealing themselves to be constantly changing, impersonal, and often contradictory processes occurring in different parts of the mind. These are insight experiences. When mindfulness allows them to sink in on an experiential level, it profoundly reprograms our intuitive view of reality, transforming a person in a wonderful way. If we believe we're separate selves who need certain external things to be happy, we'll spontaneously act out of that territorial feeling, causing harm to ourselves and others. As paradoxical as it may seem, the craving to avoid suffering and pursue pleasure is the actual cause of suffering. But when we let go of our self-centeredness, we automatically act more objectively for the good of everybody in each situation. Then we will have discovered the true source of happiness and the end of suffering. This is how mindfulness overcomes sorrow and grief and brings release from all the suffering. You may be understandably skeptical about what I'm saying. You may even doubt that such a transformation is desirable. That's all right. Use the illuminating power of mindfulness to explore these very questions. Are you your thoughts? Are you your feelings? Keep asking these questions. As your meditation improves, you'll find out for yourself. A metaphor for the levels of mindfulness. Here is a metaphor to help you remember the different levels at which mindfulness works. Say you regularly walk in the countryside, along a narrow trail with a thorn bush growing alongside it. As you start practicing mindfulness, you become present enough in daily life to recognize your options and moderate your behavior. So you're able to dodge the thorn bush, keeping your face from getting scratched or having a thorn rip a hole in your shirt. This is the first level of mindfulness. Yet the thorn bush will still be there. And if you aren't mindful tomorrow, you'll get snagged then. In other words, nothing changes in the long term. There is no magic involved in this kind of mindfulness. The magic only starts when mindfulness begins to work at the second level. When you're mindful enough in daily life, and for long enough and often enough, then consciousness can communicate the actual context and consequences of your conditioned reactions to their unconscious sources. This produces real change. It's like trimming the branches of the thorn bush hanging across your path. However, it can take a lot of trimming to clear the path, and new branches are always growing to replace them. This thorn bush has many trunks that grow from a single root. The special magic of the third level of mindfulness, the kind that happens on the cushion, is like cutting off an entire trunk at the root. When it's gone, all its branches and thorns go with it, not just the ones that happen to grow into your immediate path. And every time you purify an aspect of your deep conditioning in meditation, another major trunk is removed. Yet if the tree's root still survives, new trunks can grow back. Unless you remain vigilant, you may find that the path once again becomes overgrown. Only the fourth level of mindfulness, the insight of awakening, will finally destroy the root, meaning the thorn bush never grows back. Stage 4. Continuous attention and overcoming gross distraction and strong dullness. 4. The goal for Stage 4 is to overcome gross distraction and strong dullness. Set and hold the intention to be vigilant so that introspective awareness becomes continuous, and notice and immediately correct for strong dullness and gross distraction. Eventually, noticing and correcting become completely automatic. Practice goals for stage 4. You begin this stage with a clear sense that your attention is much more stable and continuous, and compared to previous stages, it certainly is. However, your attention still alternates, shifting almost imperceptibly fast to a sound, thought, or feeling, then returning to the breath. The meditation object always remains in attention, but not exclusively. The primary goal at this stage is to overcome the scattering of attention caused by gross distraction and strong dullness. To accomplish this, you need to develop continuous introspective awareness, allowing you to detect these problems, correct them, and return your full attention to the meditation object. While you want to completely overcome the coarser forms of distraction and dullness, you will learn to tolerate and even make use of subtle distractions and subtle dullness. They will help you navigate another important challenge of this stage, learning to identify and sustain a balance between an over-energized, easily distracted mind and a dull, lethargic mind. As your mind grows calmer and more stable in this stage, you will experience a deep purification. Stored unconscious residues from the past well up to the surface and are released. The result is a profound healing. You don't have to do anything to help things along. This purification is a natural process of the mind. Simply allow it to unfold organically. Review of gross and subtle distraction. By now you have grown quite familiar with the inner landscape of the mind, and are accustomed to how it constantly shifts and changes. Physical sensations, thoughts, memories, and emotions continue to arise and pass away in your peripheral awareness. As attention alternates rapidly between the meditation object and these other stimuli, it makes them stand out from the background, so they are more prominent than other objects in peripheral awareness. As long as the meditation object remains your primary focus, they are only subtle distractions. But often, one of these competing objects can become your primary focus. When this happens, the sensations of the breath seem to fade. They continue as an object of alternating attention, but are perceived much less clearly. This is gross distraction, the first major obstacle to overcome in this stage. Occasionally, when a particularly strong distraction becomes the center of attention, the breath will slip completely into the background to become an object in peripheral awareness. Strictly speaking, the breath is no longer an object of attention when this happens. But as long as it has not disappeared entirely from consciousness, it is different from the forgetting characteristic of stage 3. Learning to overcome gross distraction. There is a common misconception that stilling the mind means getting rid of thoughts and blocking out all distractions. Often students try to suppress these by focusing more intensely on the meditation object. This may seem like a reasonable strategy, yet brute force never works for long in meditation. You simply can't force the mind to do something it doesn't want to do. Also, since you have increased your mindfulness throughout the preceding stages, you are more conscious than ever of all the background mental activity, which also makes suppression impossible. Not only will suppressing distractions prove unsuccessful, trying to force exclusive attention on the breath would actually be a big mistake at this stage. Hyper-focused tunnel vision directed at something out there, in this case, the sensations of the breath, is exactly the kind of attention that accompanies the fight-or-flight response. This type of focus is usually accompanied by feelings of tension and anxiety, which would make your meditations agitating, frustrating, and difficult. Also, you may completely lose peripheral awareness, making you even more vulnerable to distractions and dullness. The lesson is, don't try to strong-arm your mind into a state of calm. Relax. Let it happen on its own. At this point in your practice, stilling the mind means reducing the constant movement of attention between the breath and gross distractions. The key to doing this is directing and sustaining attention. However, to succeed, you'll also need strong peripheral awareness so you can notice potential distractions before they actually capture your attention. For example, when you're carrying a full cup of hot tea through a crowded room, you want to sustain your attention on the cup while remaining aware of everything else around you. That way you can avoid a collision. Similarly, keep your primary focus on the breath and simply allow all other sensations and mental events in your peripheral awareness to just be there. Let them come, let them be, let them go. There are two steps to learning to overcome gross distractions. The first involves dealing with gross distraction that is already present. Simply continue the practice you learned in stage 3 to prevent forgetting. Recognize when a gross distraction is present, let go of it, and re-engage with the breath. The second step is a refinement of the first that prevents gross distraction from occurring in the first place. Recognize when a subtle distraction has the potential to become a gross distraction before it happens. Then tighten up your focus on the breath so the subtle distraction doesn't draw you away. Finally, engage with the breath more completely to keep it and all other distractions at bay. In both steps, you use introspective awareness to detect distractions. Then you work with directed attention to make the breath your primary focus, and with sustained attention to keep it the primary focus of attention. Let's take a closer look at this process. Cultivating continuous introspective awareness. The role of introspective awareness in these early stages is to help you catch problems so you can apply the appropriate antidote. As you progress, you constantly refine your introspective awareness to recognize increasingly subtle problems. In stage 2, you relied on spontaneous introspective awareness to recognize mind wandering. You positively reinforced this aha moment, then gently returned to the breath. In stage 3, you intentionally used introspective attention by checking in to look for gross distraction and take corrective action before forgetting happened. Using attention this way also trained and strengthened introspective awareness. In stage 4, you will develop continuous introspective awareness to observe and evaluate all distractions. But there are two drawbacks with using introspective attention to monitor the mind. The first I mentioned in stage 3. When checking in, you have to disrupt your focus on the breath. That worked then, but it doesn't now, since you're trying to cultivate continuous attention. The other problem concerns what attention sees when turned inward. The object of your introspective attention actually comes from the contents of introspective awareness in the previous moment. Introspective attention can only produce a conceptual snapshot of what was just happening, a kind of delay or echo, whereas introspective awareness is capable of continuously monitoring the mind. This is a rather subtle point. Take some time to think about it, since it has important consequences. Your new goal is to monitor the mind and detect distractions more efficiently, so that you don't interrupt attention. You achieve this by developing an intentional, vigilant, and continuous introspective awareness that alerts you to gross distractions while you remain focused on the breath. In other words, you want your attention to the breath to be a stable anchor as you keep watch over the entire ocean of the mind with introspective awareness. What does this vigilant introspective awareness feel like? Well, you're already somewhat familiar with it. In stage 3, when you return to the breath after a moment of introspective attention, you may have noticed that the quality of your awareness seemed sharper and clearer for a while. During that time, introspective awareness and attention were more balanced. If you didn't notice, try it now. Take a minute to focus on your breath and stabilize your attention. Then, introspectively, check in on the state of your mind. After a moment, return your attention to the breath. Notice how introspective awareness continues while attention remains on the breath. This is precisely the kind of introspective awareness you need to make stronger and extend until it's always there. Cultivating introspective awareness requires a shift of emphasis. Up to now, you have worked to keep a balance between attention focused on the breath and peripheral awareness of everything else, primarily everything in extrospective awareness. However, now that you have established this balance, you want to start emphasizing the introspective part of peripheral awareness. It's like standing back a bit from the meditation object, just enough to keep the breath at the center of your attention while you take in everything else happening in the mind. You want to strengthen introspective awareness, making it continuous, like a vigilant sentry who alerts you that gross distraction is present or could potentially arise. As you look beyond the meditation object, don't just look at the content of peripheral awareness. Become aware of the activities of the mind itself, movements of attention, the way thoughts, feelings, and other mental objects arise and pass away in peripheral awareness, and any changes in the clarity or vividness of perception. By using the breath as an anchor while you mindfully observe the mind, you're watching the mind while the mind watches the breath. This is metacognitive introspective awareness, and will come to full fruition by stage 8. Learning to sustain introspective awareness is extremely important for accomplishing the overall goals of meditation. It doesn't just make attention more stable. You could do that by simply bringing your attention back to the breath over and over. Rather, by anchoring your attention on the breath while maintaining introspective awareness, what you're doing is cultivating mindfulness. Mindfully observing mental processes also provides a more efficient, useful, and satisfying way to achieve stable attention. It's more efficient because you gain a better understanding of how the mind behaves, and therefore you can work more effectively. It's more useful because you will need this type of introspective awareness for the practices in the upcoming stages. And finally, it's more satisfying because your time isn't spent just plugging away, hoping for some future achievement. Instead, you're constantly engaged in a fascinating and transformative learning process. Directing and redirecting attention. Whenever you find your mind drawn into gross distraction, just let go and return to the breath. Do this in a gentle, unhurried, and even loving way. Maybe take a moment to appreciate the part of your mind that realizes you have wandered off track. Our natural tendency is to abruptly yank ourselves back to the breath. However, that will actually slow you down in the long run, so let go gently and easily instead. Any annoyance or self-judgment you may feel is just something you have to let go of. By affirming your successes, you will make quicker progress. A happy mind is a more focused mind. Don't worry if a gross distraction persists as a subtle distraction once you have returned to the breath. By just letting it be, it will usually dissipate on its own. Yet letting go and redirecting attention are only the first steps to completely overcoming gross distractions. You must also learn to tighten up your focus on the meditation object before a subtle distraction becomes a gross distraction. However, not all subtle distractions pose the same challenge to stable attention. There are two types that are especially troublesome, so you should learn to recognize them. First are the noticeably attractive subtle distractions. These draw your attention away because they hold some special allure or interest. For instance, you may be hungry and find yourself thinking about your next meal, or you may have a problem at work that keeps nagging at you. The second type of distraction doesn't exert the same kind of pull. Instead, your distraction ends up being diverted because of the manner in which the distraction arises. It sneaks in gradually, eventually displacing your focus. Once again, you need to rely on vigilant and continuous introspective awareness to distinguish these more troublesome, subtle distractions from the rest. When you notice them, you can ward them off by sharpening up your attention to the breath. Persistent distractions, pain, insights, and emotions. Sometimes a strong and persistent distraction just won't allow you to let it come, let it be, and let it go. At this stage, there are three kinds of subtle distractions that often become persistent, gross distractions: pain and physical discomfort, interesting, attractive, and seemingly important insights, and emotionally charged memories, thoughts, and visionary experiences. Having to grapple with these overwhelmingly powerful distractions can undo all the satisfaction you felt at finally being able to pay continuous attention to the breath. You may feel impatient or skeptical about the benefits of meditation or your ability to practice. However, you don't need to worry or judge yourself. At this stage, the arising of strong and persistent distractions is actually a sign of progress. You're coming into contact with primal drives, untapped capacities, hidden archetypes, and powerful emotions arising from deeper parts of the mind. Just remember that whether you're dealing with pain, brilliant insights, or powerful emotions, the goal is always the same: to overcome distractions with the right antidote, re-engage with the breath until attention becomes stable, and cultivate ever stronger introspective awareness. Let's examine these powerful distractions and the methods for dealing with them. Pain and discomfort as a distraction. Every meditator must learn to deal with pain, numbness, itching, and other potentially distracting sensations. In this stage, they become much more noticeable. During stage 3, you experienced pain and discomfort because you weren't used to sitting still for long periods. Now, pain becomes a way for the mind to resist practicing. Your mind will tend to magnify ordinary discomforts. It will even create painful sensations that have no physical cause, especially during longer sits or meditation retreats. Such pain often disappears once you make it the focus of your attention, only to show up elsewhere a little later. Regardless of its source, pain must now be confronted as part of your practice. Of course, you don't have to seek out pain, and don't suppress or ignore pain that has a definite physical origin. If you suspect your pain may be due to injury or disease but aren't sure, it's best to consult a physician. You wouldn't want your sitting posture to exacerbate any already existing condition, like an arthritic knee or a twisted ankle. You should make yourself as comfortable as possible to keep the body from interfering with training the mind. Use pillows, pads, or anything else to compensate for sensitive areas. Just remember that even with these adjustments, you will still experience unpleasant sensations. You've already learned the basic strategy for dealing with pain. Ignore unpleasant sensations as long as possible, make them your meditation object if they persist, and move mindfully only when absolutely necessary. However, at this stage, you must examine the pain even more thoroughly and wait even longer before moving. Pain is a dynamic sensation with many subtle qualities. Investigate them. Notice if it is sharp, piercing, burning, aching, dull, etc. Notice if the sensation feels solid and unchanging, or if it fluctuates in intensity, area, or location. Investigate whether your pain is one sensation or a composite of several. Search within the sensation for the source of the unpleasantness. How much of the pain you're experiencing is inherent in the sensation, and how much is your mind's reaction to the sensation? This kind of in-depth exploration will help you become as objective as possible when dealing with pain. At first, focusing on pain may only seem to intensify it. Yet after sustained investigation, pain often resolves itself. It does so in three ways. Its intensity may fade entirely. It may continue as a strong sensation, but but no longer feels particularly painful, or it may stay painful, but can be effectively disregarded. The reason pain dissipates is because you have stopped resisting and started to accept its presence. Meditation teacher Shinzen Young puts this into a mathematical formula. The amount of suffering, S, you experience, is equal to the actual pain, P, times the mind's resistance, R, to the pain. So S equals P times R. If you stop resisting completely, then R equals zero. Pain multiplied by zero equals zero. The suffering you were experiencing totally dissolves. But if you expect this to happen every time, it won't. This is because the expectation that your pain will disappear leads you back toward resistance and non-acceptance. When pain disappears completely, or continues in a form you can ignore, always return to the sensations of the breath. Repeat the entire process as necessary. Sometimes painful sensations just don't go away. When this happens, stay with the pain as your meditation object. Don't be discouraged. You can train the mind just as effectively using pain as you can with the sensations of the breath. In fact, there are certain advantages to using pain. Because it draws your attention so intensely, you're less likely to experience dullness and distraction. Also, because pain generates many thoughts and emotions, it is easier to maintain strong introspective awareness. In other words, pain is quite useful for developing stable attention and powerful mindfulness. Make good use of it. Unavoidable physical discomfort is also an opportunity to discover the true nature of pain. You will eventually learn to distinguish between physical discomfort as a sensation and the mind's unnecessary reaction to it, which is suffering. In the words of the Buddha, when the uninstructed worldling experiences a painful feeling, he feels two things, a bodily one and a mental one. When the instructed noble disciple experiences a painful feeling, he feels one thing, a bodily one, and not a mental one. Pain disappears completely in the later stages. The problem of discursive brilliance. Seemingly brilliant insights are a much more pleasant kind of gross distraction. For instance, you may find new ways of dealing with personal problems, or you may gain insights into your mind and behavior, or into profound philosophical and metaphysical concepts. These insights can emerge unbidden from the unconscious, appearing in peripheral awareness, and tempting you to take notice. Other times, they suddenly spring onto center stage. These insights are often quite valid and very useful, which is what makes them so seductive as potential distractions. Why do they arise now, at this stage? By this time, your attention has grown more stable and your mindfulness more powerful. Therefore, your mind is better able to create and link novel ideas together and can better appreciate the significance of those ideas. If you choose to pursue thinking about them, keeping your breath in peripheral awareness, you will be pleasantly surprised by how much your powers of discursive thinking have improved. In fact, your focus will be stronger than ever. You will feel excited and satisfied when you reflect on some brilliant conclusion. But then it becomes difficult to return to the breath, which usually leads you to look for something else to think about, or to get up from the cushion altogether. You may also decide that your newly discovered powers of analysis are the real benefit of meditation. If you keep engaging with these insights and thinking them through, then whenever you sit to meditate, compelling issues will arise. You will have trained your mind to make meditation into a kind of personal psychotherapy or a tool for intellectual or artistic creativity. This quickly becomes an entertaining alternative to the sometimes tedious business of training the mind. Your initial insights may indeed be significant, but as your mind continues to dredge up material, their quality will decline. They may seem profound during meditation, but if you examine them afterward, they often appear trivial. In this way, they're a lot like the brilliant ideas that sometimes happen under the influence of recreational drugs. Whether they are significant or trivial, the point is the same. Discursive brilliance quickly becomes a trap, drawing you away from the practice again and again. Overcoming this obstacle is easy. Just avoid falling into the trap. If you have meaningful insights, make a mental note of them and resolve to address them after meditating. Return your focus to the breath. It also helps if you resolve to set aside a time specifically for analytical meditation. Done as a distinct form of practice and on a separate occasion, analytical meditation on the bright ideas and insights that come up is extremely useful. Sometimes a powerful thought keeps returning. When this happens, acknowledge and accept it, then make it your temporary meditation object. However, don't analyze its content. Instead, apply a label to the thought. For example, thinking, or thought arising. This will help you keep an objective distance. Hold the thought in attention until its intensity subsides. This might take a few minutes and need to be repeated several times during the meditation. Once the intensity subsides, return to the breath. You can use this approach in other situations too. In general, whenever you can't disregard a powerful distraction, finesse the situation by intentionally making it your new meditation object. Emotions, memories, and visions as distractions. As the mind grows calm and everyday distractions fall away, significant material from the unconscious starts to well up into consciousness. This is a very significant event in the progress of your practice. However, this powerful material doesn't always surface right away, but may instead be preceded by strong feelings of restlessness and impatience. They're like the tip of an iceberg, indicating that much more lies just below the surface. So, if you experience restlessness, don't suppress it. Accept it openly, inviting whatever lies below to come up. If restlessness and impatience persists and are too strong to disregard, you will need to use the technique described later for dealing with other strong emotions. When this material does become conscious, it can take two forms. It may appear as memories, thoughts, or visions, accompanied by strong and often difficult emotions, or it can manifest as just the raw emotions themselves, fear, sadness, anger, etc., unaccompanied by any mental object. Because they are unaccompanied, it may seem like these naked emotions have no cause. In this way, they are similar to the nonspecific or free-floating anxiety for which people seek therapy. Yet this is all perfectly normal in meditation. In fact, as we'll explain, it's another sign you're making progress. This disruptive material comes from past emotional and psychological challenges, and the more of these you've faced, the more you'll encounter. Some may be quite traumatic, such as sexual abuse, the loss of a parent, or childhood bullying. But major challenges aren't the only cause. Lesser trials that easily go unrecognized, like teasing, parental favoritism, or the pains of adolescence, play their part as well. Charged, unconscious material will also arise if you've internalized dysfunctional or conflicting belief systems. For example, you may believe in sexual liberation, but still experience inner conflict because of the sexual mores you were taught as a child. Or, you may have a deeply internalized work ethic that makes you feel guilty when you meditate because you think you aren't being productive. In some cases, you'll be quite clear about what created the strong thoughts or emotions, especially if the cause was traumatic. But you may be unaware of the more commonplace and subtle traumas that reinforced this charged material. However, in many instances, these strange thoughts or distressing images may seem to have little or nothing to do with you or with anything you've ever experienced. Yet remember, nothing in meditation is ever random or meaningless. You may not know where some painful emotion or vision came from, But no matter how bizarre or unpleasant it may seem, you can be sure that something in your history caused it. For instance, you may have picked up or embellished a violent image from a movie that you've long forgotten. Whether you know the cause or not isn't important. You can be sure that everything arising during meditation forms part of your psychic makeup. None of it is unimportant or beside the point. Images arise because they symbolize material your mind isn't comfortable confronting more directly. Learn to fully embrace everything that surfaces. They are hidden parts of your psyche. More importantly, understand and rejoice in the fact that when this material comes to the surface, it's an act of purification and a critical step toward developing shamatha. In the stillness of meditation, the magic of mindfulness integrates this difficult content buried in the unconscious in a healthy and healing way. The strategy for dealing with emotions, thoughts, or images is simply to ignore them for as long as you can. Then, just like with pain, when something becomes too strong to disregard, make it your meditation object. Don't resist, avoid, or reject this potent material. It will only go back into the unconscious and resurface again later. Acknowledging, allowing, and accepting are the antidotes to avoiding, resisting, and rejecting. Acknowledge the validity of whatever comes up, even if you don't know its origin. Allow it to be there without analyzing or judging it, while you keep cultivating the standpoint of an objective observer. Last, accept it as a manifestation of some hidden part of yourself. It's important not to get bogged down in examining the content of unconscious material. That's time-consuming and can interrupt your progress. How do you learn to handle this charged material objectively without getting caught up in it? First, maintain a strong, clear awareness of where you are and what you're doing. That in this present moment, you're safe, secure, and sitting comfortably in meditation. Then isolate the emotional aspect of the experience. If you're having unpleasant memories, for instance, deal first with the emotions that accompany them. Only then will you be able to view those memories objectively and dispassionately enough to accept the past events they depict and let the memories go. In the same way, if you're dealing with disturbing projections from your imagination, you must confront their emotional component before you can accept and let go of the images. And, of course, you have to directly address those raw emotions that sometimes arise with no apparent cause. In every case, address the emotions first. You want to create some objective distance from these unpleasant emotions. Verbalizations are important for this. If you have the thought, "I am angry," replace it with the thought, "Anger is arising." This kind of rephrasing isn't just useful to avoid getting tangled up in emotions. It's simply more accurate. You're not these feelings. There is no self in emotions. Remember that, like everything else, emotions arise due to specific causes and conditions and pass away when their causes disappear. Do your best to dissociate from these emotions, keeping the role of an objective observer, even though that can be challenging. Dissociating doesn't mean you don't feel the emotions fully, or that you try to pour cold water on them. It means you let the emotions come into consciousness and do their dance, without getting absorbed in them. When confronting emotions, always start by investigating the physical sensations that accompany them. As with pain, this is the most effective way of staying objective. Every emotion has its own characteristic sensations and related bodily movements. Scan your own body to discover these for yourself. What are the specific bodily sensations that go with this particular emotion? Where are they located? Are they pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Are they changing intensity? Are they expanding and contracting, or solid and fixed? Do they change in quality, or stay the same? Only when you're ready, turn your attention from the physical to the mental aspects of the emotion. Without getting caught up in your subjective experience, try to find a label that accurately describes the emotion. For example, anxiety, guilt, lust, and quality. For example, intense, vague, agitating. Notice what kinds of thoughts the emotion triggers. Is the emotion getting more or less intense, or staying fairly constant? Perhaps the emotion is transforming. For example, anxiety can morph into fear, and fear into anger, and anger into guilt. Again, it's helpful to use verbal labels such as anxiety is arising to remain objective. As you might have guessed, this process can be very tiring. If necessary, take a break from meditation and rest, or do something else. As long as you stay objective and don't identify with the emotion, you won't suffer in the process. If you do find yourself suffering, physically or emotionally, you can be sure that you're identifying with some unpleasant emotion. Try to see if you can spot where it's happening. The mind works in subtle ways. You can stay objective toward one emotion while at the same time identifying with another. For instance, when you investigate anger, there may be an undercurrent of fear. Without realizing it, you may remain objective toward the anger but identify with the fear. Practicing introspective awareness will help you handle these subtler, more hidden kinds of emotional identification. While keeping your attention focused on the primary emotion, use introspective awareness to find the background emotion that you're identifying with. Then make the background emotion the new object of attention. Once you have gained some objectivity toward that emotion, the suffering will go away. No matter the emotion, your goal is always the same: acknowledge, allow, and accept. As meditation teacher Joseph Goldstein says, it's not what we are feeling that's important, but how we relate to it that matters. Let the emotion just be until it goes away. Sometimes it will simply disappear. Other times it will remain, but become less intense. When this happens, unless there are associated memories or images that have not yet faded, it's time to return to the meditation object as the primary focus. If you find there are associated memories or images that have not yet faded, simply observe them without engaging or judging them. They may have been present while you were focusing on the emotion, or they may have appeared after the emotion started to subside. Either way, acknowledge their presence and accept them with equanimity. Then, when it's easy to do, return your attention to the breath. The thoughts or images may disappear at once,